This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
This podcast brought to you by My Patriot Supply. Did you miss the chance to get a 72-hour emergency food supply with free shipping for just $10? What's wrong with you? Don't worry. Call 888-411-7440 right now. They have a few left, and they're selling out fast. 888-411-7440. What are you waiting for? A disaster? Do it right now. 888-411-7440.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. Got a lot to get to. Let's kick it off by talking about the Climate Change Summit in Paris. Oh, mais oui, bien sûr. They're having a summit in Paris right now. They are talking about all things climate-related. Now, you will note that this is an area where I get particularly annoyed. I find it hard to even see a middle or common ground with many of the climate change alarmists. You will note that they will say things that are so crazy that it's impossible to debate them because you're just wondering, are they really serious? Can they actually believe that? Do they really think that the entire world is at risk if they don't get some kind of unenforceable bureaucratic agreement? Which I will get into the details of in just a moment, what the agreement is supposedly going to look like, right? That's why they're there for 2 weeks now, to hammer this thing out. Remember that the leadership here is supposed to be coming from the Obama administration, the same people who brought you the Iran deal. You know, that deal that didn't destroy any of Iran's nuclear infrastructure, didn't require Iran to dismantle any of its nuclear infrastructure. In fact, just made Iran a lot richer and more or less brought it into the community of nations, and at some point it's going to have a very advanced nuclear program. And we're going to say, great, hope you enjoy your nuclear program, Iran. Yeah, that same deft negotiating tactic the administration deployed there, which is anything to get a deal, anything to get a deal. How much is that used car? I don't even care. Here's a blank check. Anything to get a deal. That is not just the mentality of the Obama administration going into these Paris climate talks, but in fact, it is the mentality of most of the Western nations that are there. See, this is really broken down into countries that are self-deluded and countries that are deeply cynical, right? Oh, yeah, you think Russia's really going to enforce its climate change agreement on itself? Now, this is one of the phenomenal things they keep bringing up. It's going to be enforceable. How is an agreement like this enforceable? What exactly are you going to do? You're going to have the climate change police show up and arrest the Russian government or the Indian government or the Chinese government? That would be quite a feat, wouldn't it?
Excuse me, sir. You're not hitting your climate change intergovernmental panel results, and you're going to have to come with me.
I don't think that's going to work. I think that's problematic. I don't think anybody really believes that this is going to change much of anything when it comes to saving the world, but it is going to change some things when it comes to economies in the developed world, perhaps, maybe, a little bit. Depends on how crazy we really are. Now, if you want gravitas for your global summit with over 190 world leaders there, I mean, this is like the Oscars for political leaders, right? This is everybody showing up, What's Merkel wearing this year? Oh, look, it's a business suit. Big surprise. But they're talking about this as though it's going to be an issue of life or death for the planet. And there's so many levels of crazy here that it's hard to even get into it. Now, keep in mind that there are very real issues that they could spend their time, that these world leaders could be discussing. There are things that we really do need to address. We could talk, for one, about actually having some strategy for the defeat and destruction of the Islamic State, for example. But no, that's a real enemy. It's so much more fun to conjure up a fake enemy, to tilt at windmills, to come up with some make-believe boogeyman monster that you get to feel tall and proud as you fight against. And then you realize it's not fighting back because it's not there. There's nothing there. And yet here we are. 190-plus world leaders at this climate change summit, opened up by, 150 world leaders, representatives of over 190 countries, the heads of 151 nations. And then there are, you know, there are all these other delegates and negotiators who are in there. I mean, I don't want to overstate this. Still, a lot of people. It's the biggest of these climate change summits ever. And there's been sort of a series of these stretching all the way back. You'll remember, in fact, that it fell apart, I think it was in 97 in Kyoto. And this was something that was a talking point of the left for a while, the Kyoto protocols, because we're like, well, that will just hurt our economy. And we don't think it's a good idea. Yeah, 1997, Kyoto. And ultimately, we decided that because China and India weren't signing on, that wasn't going to happen. Now China and India say they're going to sign on. So, oh, it must be great. But if you're trying to create gravitas for your global summit of 150 plus world leaders, if you're trying to make sure that this is all about the science, who better to have speak on behalf of your cause than somebody whose entire position in life is literally entirely inherited? Somebody who is a monarch of a monarchy with no power that's really in existence at this point so that people can sell tabloid newspapers. Yes, yes, of course. Let's have Prince Charles of the United Kingdom, noted person who was born into the royal family. That's it. Nothing else. Not noted scientist. Not noted brain. In fact, has said some wow, stupid level kind of stuff. But he says that climate change is, in fact, in a world, by the way, with nuclear weapons, in a world that pandemic disease, that if there was a pandemic disease outbreak, many experts say we don't even know what the end result would be. We don't know how many tens of millions would die. And there have been pandemic disease outbreaks before that have, say, killed a third of Europe or tens of millions of people with Spanish influenza around the world or whatever. This has happened. It happened in history and is provable and real. Not pandemic disease, not nuclear war. None of those things are the big threats that face us, right? That's not the big problem. The big problem is this. The temperature of the world in the year 2100. Yes, that's in fact the year they're trying to project out to. They want to make sure that they keep the level of warming below 2 degrees Celsius. Oh, because the scientific community has consensus, right? No, in fact, if you look at the IPCC report, which I read, which is insanely boring. I read the executive summary of it and try to get through the rest of it, and there's just a lot of it that's could be, maybe, on the one hand, on the other hand. But you got Prince Charles here laying it down, saying that this is the biggest threat facing the world. Clip 6. Play it.
Humanity faces many threats, but none is greater than climate change. It magnifies every hazard and tension of our existence. It threatens our ability to feed ourselves, to remain healthy and safe from extreme weather, to manage the natural resources that support our economies, and to avert the humanitarian disaster of mass migration and increasing conflict.
And I stand before you as evidence of the problems that come from monarchical succession and the shortened gene pool and family tree that looks more like a telephone pole. Sir, thank you and a good day to you. I can't believe this guy. I can't believe this guy. This is not good. You got this guy standing up here saying he's the biggest threat that faces the world. You would think to yourself, well, this is obviously crazy, right? Nobody could really believe this. Nobody could actually believe it. Climate change is come on. Are we being serious here? There's some other stuff out there that you would assume world leaders. Is this guy even a world leader, by the way? I don't know. I have to ask some of our British friends. It's part of a monarchy that has no power. It's, it's sort of symbolic. Okay. So he's one of the only, there's only a handful allowed to speak before various world leaders took the stage, and he's saying that we are the architects of our own destruction. This is crazy talk on so many levels. Now, I could get into all the false predictions in the past, or the wrong predictions, I should say, in the past. And you'll notice how it's always on a 10-year timeline, meaning they project out and say that in 100 years, we're all going to be dead. And if we don't act in this way within the next 10 years, then we're going to be on this pathway that's it would be irretrievable. The world's future would be irretrievable from this pathway if we get on. It's always 10 years, which is just about the extent to which everybody will kind of forget what was said 10 years ago. Isn't that amazing? We're never on a six-month timeline, right? Because then if it passes, well, hey, smoke them if you got them. The world's toast. It's always on a 10-year timeline. And you can go back. You go back to 2000, go back to 1990, go back to 1980, go back to 1970. And you'll see scientists saying, oh, if we don't do something, if we don't dramatically change course within 10 years, it's all over. 10 years passes. We haven't dramatically changed course. A lot more CO2 in the air. CO2, which, you know, it's good for plants. We don't change course. The world doesn't end. But by that point, everyone's forgotten, and there's new evidence. There's new scaremongering. There's new drowned polar bears. Couldn't get from one ice floe to the next. Just ask Al Gore. Look at his movie. Polar bears are drowning. That's what they were saying. Actually, the polar bear population in Alaska is very healthy right now. I think it's larger than it's been in decades. Nonetheless, doesn't matter, because that was then. This is now. They keep changing the story. Oh, and there's all the scandals, of course, about manipulating scientific data. Where else do you see that happening, by the way? Where else do you see somebody who all of a sudden decides that whatever the results of the test they're doing scientifically may be, they're just going to change them. They're going to, quote, hide the decline. They're going to do whatever they have to do to make it look a certain way. This feels a lot more like religious belief, a sort of global earth spiritualism instead of actual science. And as I've pointed out to you in the past, if this was done, say, in the clinical trials of a heart disease medication. Oh, I mean, you know, the side effects. You know, we got side effects in like 30% of the cases. The guy just dropped dead of a heart attack. But we figure, you know, the other 70% is good. So we just changed it and said, no, 99% effective. Bam, done. USDA approved. FDA approved. FDA, not USDA. We're not selling potatoes. But still, FDA approval. If that was shown to happen, you would not just be liable from a civil standpoint. I think you'd be criminally liable, too, if you faked drug results and people died. Check out the plot of The Fugitive. It's a good movie. It's a good movie indeed. He switched the samples. He did. He switched the samples. If you did that, you'd be in a lot of trouble. In climate change science, you can switch the samples all the time. And you get to stand around and just say, my friend Richard Kimball is not well. Those of you who remember the movie know exactly what I'm talking about. Great movie. If you haven't seen it, seen it. Anyway, climate change stuff. You'd think that maybe this is just the dauphin, the heir to the British monarchy is just kind of going off the rails here. But there's going to be, you know, more sober talk from world leaders. There's going to be more sort of grounded in reality. And then President Obama decides he's going to talk about it. And he wants to warn you about something. He wants to warn you about cynicism. That's what he's got coming here. Play clip one, President Obama on this climate talk.
I've come here personally as the leader of the world's largest economy and the second largest emitter, to say that the United States of America not only recognizes our role in creating this problem, we embrace our responsibility to do something about it. One of the enemies that we'll be fighting at this conference is cynicism, the notion we can't do anything about climate change. Our progress should give us hope during these 2 weeks. Hope that is rooted in collective action.
So much wrong here. First of all, you'll notice that President Obama, he sort of has two different ways of presenting when he's speaking publicly. You know, sometimes there's the, you know, sort of like this, or he's doing this thing, and he's talking to people. And other times, we better have the, you know, he sort of does the declamation, the modern Cicero is very professorial sounding, and it depends on what effect he's going for at any given time. Look, people do this, of course. You know, there's sort of off-the-cuff talk, and there's when you're giving a speech. For President Obama, there's quite a differential between the two styles of presentation. But a couple things. First of all, when he talks about how we're the second biggest emitter, that's just because we're naughty. We're just naughty with our emissions. We're just the second biggest emitter, and that's naughty, and we shouldn't do that. Naughty America with your emissions. Yeah, of course. And we have a huge economy, a lot of people, and we are very productive. And that productivity relies in large part on fossil fuels. And those fossil fuels burning releases CO2 into the air. CO2 is already in the air. It is not a pollutant. Plants like it. But I digress. Now the EPA can regulate CO2 as a pollutant, which is just crazy. And I don't say crazy here. You know, sometimes you say something's crazy just because you don't want to deal with it. It's like, oh, you know. Healthcare premiums are rising. That's just crazy. And that's just sort of a way of, you know, this is, I'm sure some of you, when you're at your Thanksgiving table, you had the uncle, you're like, ah, oh, Bob, you know, he's just crazy, which is a nice way of saying, wow, did you hear what he said? That guy's going to get us all in trouble. But in this case, I actually mean crazy as in separated from reality, as in at some level of derangement. Now, we could talk about this for hours. I want to focus in on why, even if climate change were real in a way that is dangerous to the world, even if I conceded all of this stuff that I do not concede, but even if that were true, let's go hang out in Fantasyland. Let's go to Candyland where there's, you know, rivers of chocolate milk and there's candy canes and unicorns and woo. Let's do that together and look at what this agreement would do once we had conceded all the stuff that we do not concede. Is the agreement even worthwhile if they can reach it? The answer is going to come on the other side of this break. I'll be back in just a minute.
This is the Buck Sexton Show
on the Blaze Radio Network.
This podcast brought to you by My Patriot Supply. Did you miss the chance to get a 72-hour emergency food supply with free shipping for just $10? What's wrong with you? Don't worry. Call 888-411-7440 right now. They have a few left, and they're selling out fast. 888-411-7440. What are you waiting for? A disaster? Do it right now. 888-411-7440.
Dispensing the truth.
This is Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.
You know, team, you don't have to take my word for it. I'm not a scientist. As my freshman biology teacher or my sophomore chemistry teacher could well attest to, I am not a scientist. But I am a rational human being who does a fair amount of reading and pays attention to what's going on. You don't have to believe me, though, on this stuff. Yeah, you could say, oh, Buck, but you're not, you don't sit around there looking at the tree rings, which, by the way, a very, very ineffective and difficult way of determining what the climate was hundreds or thousands of years ago. But anyway, you may not be the guy who does that. But let me tell you that some of the biggest scaremongers on the scene when it comes to climate change are coming out saying, "Well, this is like a huge deal, bro. But like, this isn't going to do anything about it. This deal isn't going to actually make a difference, brah." And that's true. It will not. This is a giant bonfire of the insanities. This is a bunch of people gathering together so that they can stand proud and tall and feel like they're engaged in all this savior of the world crap, this moral grandstanding. It will mean nothing. It is zero, I promise you. And you don't have to take my word for it. You've got many people writing this who believe in climate change, who are climate change alarmists, whom I would disagree with on any number of things. Any number of things. They don't even buy this. They're like, nah, I mean, this is not going to do anything, right? I mean, you're kidding me, right? I mean, come on. I mean, we're going to talk about this. Let's talk about this. This isn't actually going to help anything. Why the Paris climate deal is meaningless. A piece right now on Politico, in Politico's Europe section by Oren Cass. Writes things like, for example, after all this, the final submissions from all this negotiating from the 2 weeks of, oh, how are we going to make this work? It's going to save the planet. All the final submissions, quote, are not enforceable and carry no consequences beyond shame for noncompliance, a fact bizarrely taken for granted by all involved. Perhaps not surprisingly, the submitted plans are even less impressive than the process that produced them. In aggregate, the promised emissions reductions will barely affect anticipated warming. A variety of inaccurate apples-to-orange comparisons have strained to show significant progress. And the MIT Joint Program on the Science and Policy of Global Change calculates the improvement by century's end. By the end of a century after all this, okay? At the year 2100. That's what they're talking about now. They have no idea what's going to happen in 2100, what the state of energy technology will be, what the world... They have no idea. And as I've told you many times before, we're already naturally decarbonizing from wood to coal to oil to natural gas to the other stuff that we're now trying to make cost effective that is not yet cost effective, the renewables. But that's coming. It is coming. And I'm not trying to stand athwart that progress. I believe in real scientific progress, not make-believe scientific progress. But by the end of the century, according to this political piece, you're looking at a 0.2 degree Celsius change if we do all the stuff they want us to do. This is going to put massive restrictions on developed economies. The developing world, by the way, is getting a pass on this whole thing, which is why they're on board. And so eventually, this is really just a means of a massive wealth transfer from the first world to the developing, poorer world. And it does nothing. There's no real effect from any of this. This is sound and fury signifying nothing. But you got a bunch of bureaucrats get together and eat lots of croissants.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, as many of you no doubt saw, there was a shooting over the holiday weekend at a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs. It killed three, including a deputy, a police officer, and it wounded nine. Killed a veteran, it killed a mother. This, as you can imagine, has immediately opened up many of the political fault lines that you could expect when anything at all happens at a Planned Parenthood clinic. You have pro-life groups uniformly and across the country finding this abhorrent, and this is anti-life. Killing somebody is the antithesis of being pro-life. Killing innocent people is the antithesis of being pro-life. So that's obvious on its face, but it didn't take long at all. It was really just a matter of minutes. As soon as they could start the presses turning, turn on the cameras, get the websites fired up, all of a sudden it became a highly politicized issue. And there are a couple of things that I wanted to spend some time with you on working through this. First, of course, if one's purpose, and this is even beyond where we could go with this particular shooter, Robert Louis Deere is his name. If in this case you want to make the assumption, or you believe that there's enough, I shouldn't say it's a total assumption, because there's evidence obviously by the choice of target, and I don't want to do what the left does. Oh, you know, the Chattanooga shooting, I have no idea what happened here, and we all know what happened there, right? We know. But in this case, it looks like obviously he targeted a Planned Parenthood clinic. The guy's crazy. There's plenty of evidence to that as well. Not crazy in the, oh, he has political beliefs I don't like sense, or that he subscribes to an ideology that is widely held around the world by many millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions in the form of jihad. But let's pretend it doesn't exist. No, he's crazy in the sense of muttering to himself and, you know, rolling around in his own waste sometimes, probably. I mean, that's crazy, right? That's what we're talking about here. The guy has a level of derangement. But in looking at this, there are automatically a lot of assumptions that are being brought to bear. And so I wanted to take a moment to sort of step back and talk about a few things. First of all, if his purpose was to in any way, if it was related to just shutting down abortion clinics, I mean, he has now, we'll be hearing about this abortion clinic shooting for decades to come. And this will now, and you'll be hearing about right-wing terrorism and GOP terrorism and pro-life terrorism. You'll be hearing about this now for the next 30 years. I really mean that. The next 20 to 30 years, you will hear about this every time you bring up the sale of body parts at Planned Parenthood clinics, or, I'm sorry, the non-for-profit transfer of fetal tissue dismembered as though it were nothing at all, and for which compensation was received, but compensation not in excess of the assumed cost of the procedure. Selling body parts. Okay. So the next time you bring that up, though, for the next 20 years, people will bring up Robert Louis Deere. And so he has done, not only has he murdered people in cold blood, which is disgraceful and should be charged to the fullest extent of the law, and he will be. But on top of that, he has very dramatically harmed any, if he was in his own crazy mind in some way tied to a pro-life cause. This has now made it much harder to convince people to come to the pro-life side. This has now given the left something to point to for all it for as I said, decades to come, to say, see, those pro-life people, the people that say, have your baby, life is precious, raise your baby, love your baby, they're crazy, they're terrorists, and they will point to this guy. Is that fair? Of course not. But that's what's going to happen. It's already happening. I look at this now, and I also see two things that are very that have happened right away, and they are distinct from other situations where there is a mass shooting, which is what this is, right? Anytime it's more than two, it's considered a mass shooting, and so here we or two or more rather, it's a mass shooting, and so here we are, and it was a fatal shooting. And when you look at this, though, there are a couple of things. One, there is an immediate effort to, in this case, to have a motive, right? They kind of know the motive right away. They don't wait on the motive. And in this case, the motive may, in fact, be pretty obvious, right? I mean, in this case, it looks like he went after a Planned Parenthood clinic. Okay, he's crazy, but that's what he did. And in his mind, maybe thought he was, you know, this was what he needed to do, whatever. He's crazy. He's going after this. It is a form of, it is something where you can take the motive pretty quickly, I think, and understand what it is, right? The motive is he thinks that what they're doing is wrong, and he's going to take the law into his own hands, and he's going to violate the law and kill people. So we know what the motive is, but they go with the motive really quickly. There's not all this backpedaling. There's not all this hesitation. Oh, hold on a second. Even though you have a law enforcement source who would only speak anonymously, said that when he was rambling, he said, no more baby parts, end quote. So that's, of course, meant to tie all of this immediately to the Center for Medical Progress and their videos, the undercover videos. This is to discredit all of that. This is to set back the media seizing upon this rhetoric, set back the entire pro-life movement. Roughly half the country, right, pro-life. But now this one guy. This isn't like we look at the Pew polls of jihad and stuff around the world we talk about. I think it's very interesting. We're going to get into the demonization of an ideology in a second here. There's one guy in no way who is crazy, and there's plenty of evidence to that, right? Who's a loner, who mutters to himself, who's a weirdo. We get it. This one guy is now used to tarnish the beliefs of half the country, right? Call it 150 million people, roughly. One guy, and how many? And by the way, when was the last time you heard about the Family Research Council and the shooting that occurred there? Oh yeah, you don't hear about that very often, right? That would be left wing Democrat terrorism, technically, I guess, right? But you won't hear very much about this at all. By the way, the Federalist has a very good piece on this that I would recommend to all of you. Stop blaming pro-lifers for the Colorado Spring shooting. This is by our friend Ben Dominich. He wrote this on the Federalist, and he breaks down some of these arguments as well in a way that I think is well worth your time to take a moment and read through, because there are some very interesting differences here. And for example, he points out that Floyd Corkins walked into the Family Research Council and opened fire and explicitly cited the Southern Poverty Law Center as the source of his anger. So a guy walks into the walks into the Family Research Council, and because of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is just a leftist group that sort of in Alinsky fashion targets and isolates people for destruction, and is just a left-wing hack job all around. That is incited as evidence of left-wing terrorism. That's just a lone gunman. He's crazy, whatever. In this case, it's not a lone gunman who's crazy. This is the vanguard. This is what the media is saying, and this is what they're inferring. Some of them will say it. Some of them will imply it. This is the vanguard of the pro-life movement right here. This guy is representative of it. Isn't it fascinating when they take the anomaly, the statistically insignificant act of one, right? Statistically meaning how many other people are there who are pro-life? How many people do this? And they will try to use this to tarnish the entire group. To everybody, to anyone within the GOP, anybody who's pro-life, now they will use this to maximum political effect. So there is an effort to demonize right away. The motive is clear right away to them. They don't do this. And I do think the motive is pretty clear, but the point is, compare it to Chattanooga. Have you heard it? When was the last time you heard somebody call that a terrorist shooting, by the way? Young Muslim American picks a few military recruiting centers, writes a bunch of stuff on the internet that makes it sound like he wants to wage a little jihad, goes and shoots up a bunch of our servicemen. I'm not sure what that's all about. Maybe he just had a bad day. I don't know. They waited and waited. We can't declare motive. I was on TV this morning. How do you know it's jihad? Because I'm not a moron. That's how I know it's jihad. Did this guy attack Planned Parenthood because he has in his head, he thinks that this is a way that he's going to stop abortion? Yeah, it looks pretty clear that that's what he did. Do we know it 100%? No, but you'll notice that the media is not sitting back on this. They're not saying, oh, they're right away. Oh, and they've done a full bio. I mean, they've got a biography on this guy pretty much already on the New York Times. Everything about him. Did you know he's from the South? Did you know that he has family members who go to Christian churches? You know, it's all this stuff. Oh, they love this in the New York Times. They want to use this as the pinnacle, as the prototype for what the pro-life movement's actually all about. Again, the pro-life movement. You do not kill people as part of the pro-life movement. Nothing could be more obvious or straightforward, but in this instance, the media's sacrament of the left is abortion. You mess with that, they're coming after you. And they'll do anything. They'll do anything to tarnish the other side of this argument. And this now, this individual, this lunatic loner, just look at, I mean, look, you look at this guy, you read his background, and you go, this guy's wacko. This guy's like the Unabomber. But Robert Louis Deere is not going to be a name that you hear for many years to come. You won't hear about the Family Research Council shooting guy. How many of you even knew what his name was? And I have to be honest with you, I had to look it up too. Because you don't hear it a lot. You don't hear Floyd Corkins all the time. Oh, yeah, that's right. There are left-wing nutjobs who go shoot up right-wing, or I should say conservative, pro-life, pro-family institutions for being pro-life and pro-family. That does happen, too. And yet you're not going to hear, you're not going to have 24/7 media coverage of the issue of that and pretend that that somehow is representative of all Democrats, all pro-choice people. So, as I said, motive? There's no holding back. Right away, they're going to jump onto the motive, even though they're pulling this quote from a long ramble, and it's an anonymous law enforcement source, and right away they want to establish this was the motive. And again, I'm not saying it's not the motive. I'm merely saying that compare it to other instances where there's a mass shooting that doesn't fit into the left-wing narrative, and they act like a bunch of I don't know, Chattanooga. They act like a bunch of morons. It's very obvious what happened in Chattanooga. I was going on TV. Every person that I knew and respected from an FBI and CIA background or anywhere within law enforcement or the intel community that went on TV after the Chattanooga shooting was saying the same thing. And yet still people would ask me, well, you really think that we know what the motive is here? Yeah, dude, I think we know what the motive is here. Again, no hesitation, no trying to pull the heat out of the news cycle with this. The motive is clear right away. The demonization happens right away. Now, look, you demonize Robert Louis Deere all day. That guy's a cold-blooded killer. I'm talking about the demonization of an entire political spectrum. I'm talking about the demonization of the entire pro-life movement of really the GOP, white males, conservative Christians. This is now just the whole thing. This guy, this weirdo who lived by himself in some trailer off the grid who, you know, mumbled and... This guy is representative of tens of millions of people, over 100 million people. It depends on who you ask over at the New York Times and other left-wing outfits. This is the standard bearer for the American right now in the eyes of left-wing media. That's what they're going to do. And it's just so obvious. It's just such obvious propaganda. You'll also notice, by the way, there's not any, as you will see with jihad, these are the two places I think we can most easily compare, right? When there's a mass shooting in the name of jihad. When Fort Hood happens, I hope diversity is not a casualty. We don't really know what's going on here. You know, the media is sort of, oh, whoa, hold on a second. We don't want to jump to conclusions. We don't want his Islamic background to be at issue here. Oh, no, it was at issue. It was at issue. They do all these tricks, all these acrobatics, whatever they have to do to try to massage the message and divert attention. Switch things around. With this, they focus in like a laser. This guy's representative, even though numerically and otherwise completely unrepresentative of anything from the right, from pro-life movements. In fact, what he did is literally antithetical to the very name of the movement itself. But the media plays dirty. And in this case, they're just going to say, oh, you know, you're one of these people that goes on one of these pro-life marches or you stand outside a clinic and try to convince somebody with your voice. Not barring their path, because there are laws that you can't bar their path. That law, by the way, doesn't exist apparently in New York City when there's a march of Occupy Wall Street activists or Black Lives Matter activists. They can block me from getting to work. They can lie down in the street. They can do whatever they want. And people usually leave them, you know, the police leave them alone. They can block my path, but, you know, it's sacred, your access to Planned Parenthood. That's sacred. You can't even have to walk around somebody. You got to just have straight path. It's a federal law. So Robert Louis Deere is supposed to be emblematic of now the entire right, according to the media. This is deeply disingenuous. It's wrong. It is not based in any truth. But that's what they're going to do. That's what they're going to say. So again, the motive is clear to them right away. The demonization happens. You don't have anybody standing back and saying, wait a minute, isn't the pro-life movement all about life? And aren't Christians about loving thy neighbor as thyself? And you won't hear any of that. Isn't this guy anti-Christian? Isn't this guy anti-pro-life movement? Isn't this guy outside of all of that? Hasn't he hijacked an ideology, you could say, or hasn't he done something that has nothing to do with Christianity? You'll hear this. Somebody will yell Allahu Akbar, blow up a plane, has nothing to do with Islam. This guy, we don't even really know what his deal is. We know he's nuts, and I mean clinically nuts, not nuts because we don't like what he believes. And right away, it's almost like he's the leader of, if you believe the New York Times, you believe these other places, a leader in the pro-life movement. Because whatever works for the narrative. So the demonization occurs right away. There's no attempt to sort of soft pedal it. There's no attempt to take some of the sting out of it or anything else. It's just everybody. See, this is what they are. That's what they're trying to say. This, meaning Robert Louis Deere, is what they, meaning people who are like, hey, I believe in life and I think you should have your baby and raise your baby and love your baby and not make this choice to go to Planned Parenthood. They're all the same. It's evil, actually. It's an evil connection to make. And the media is making it left and right. And they didn't even stop there. I haven't even gotten to the politicization of it. The secondary politicization of it, gun control. We'll hit that in just a minute. I'll be right back.
Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.
Listening to the Buck Sexton Show
only on the Blaze Radio Network.
So, team, I just wanted to point out that President Obama immediately has decided that not only is this an issue that has to be allowed to demonize the right away, he also says this is about gun control. He's telling us that if we're going to do something about this, then we have to do something about the easy accessibility of weapons of war in our streets. So, gun control out of the Planned Parenthood shooting, too. Utter politicization.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. I want to talk to you about a story that's currently on theblaze.com, courtesy of Dave Urbanski, one of our Blaze editors. Man accused of slapping teen relative for not wearing Muslim headscarf is not a University of Missouri professor. This is from just in the last 24 hours. So initially it was reported that this man was University of Missouri is Mizzou, right? A Mizzou professor. But yes, thank you, Ty. But the reality is that the school has come out and said that he's not, in fact, tied to them. That doesn't really matter. That's not what I wanted. Initially it was a couple of things, right? It was a man abusing a 14-year-old girl, violently attacking her for not wearing the hijab, which is a broad spectrum term for Islamic covering of a female. It's a female dress code, essentially, or female method of dress, I should say. And the hijab, as Arabists and people who are scholars of Islam or even just random passersby, you know, a little something about it, will tell you hijab can mean very different things in different places. But there are some commonalities. There are some similarities that I would like to address and also get into this discussion again for a minute here about Islamic values and American values and Western values and whether they are entirely compatible. Let's put that out there for a second. This story is about a man who sees his 14-year-old relative. It's not even clear from the story right now on the Blaze what the exact relationship is, but she is at high school and she is not wearing a headscarf, right? And, of course, people will point out some headscarves almost look like a Eastern European kerchief around the head. Some headscarves are all the way down into the shoulders, and sometimes they also then add a full body covering on top of that. And there are different terms for all of this, right? There's the chador in Iran. There's the abaya in Saudi. The niqab is the face veil. And there's all these different terms, and you can get into the variations of this. But what I wanted to speak to you about is that the hijab, which is often discussed as some sort of a mild cultural distinction, right? An issue of culture, sort of like saying, I like T-shirts, you like button downs, right? That's the way it's presented to us. And in a huge number of cases, when I say huge number, I mean, if you look at Islam around the world, if you look at various Islamic countries, that's complete nonsense. It is, in fact, considered a moral issue, not a sort of cultural idiosyncratic issue. It's not, I wear this because it is something that, it's something that we do here in whatever this country is. I dress this way because that's a part of it. You want to fit in. But it also has moral implications. And this is one of these places where the American left is most vulnerable, particularly American feminists, which I find fascinating. You have these feminists who will defend policies in countries that mandate a certain degree of covering. And keep in mind that if you are not covered appropriately, the sanctions for this can be swift and severe. There are a number of instances of women who receive horrible beatings and abuse. Even in recent weeks, you read about this from the Islamic State, but you can read about this in Saudi Arabia, too. Just go through the news. You'll see. It's not an issue of I like to dress a certain way in many places around the world. It can be that issue. Depends. This is where, and I know where the discussion always goes. People say, oh, well, look at Turkey. Women are choosing to cover in Turkey. Well, people are also being told that that's what a pious, a devout, a godly, in the sense of Allah being God, woman would do. But where the collision occurs, and France is actually ground zero for this debate in the West, is when people say, you know what, that's a separation, you can't cover your face. You can't wear overt religious displays, by the way, Christian as well. And all of a sudden now you have, well, it's not just we like to dress that way, it's this is the way moral women dress. And men will enforce this dress code, this draconian dress code, such as it is, in ways that are horrific to us. But, of course, modern feminists are very quiet about this. I've even read articles. I read an article by a well-noted feminist whose name currently escapes me about how she felt when she went to the Muslim world that the hijab made her feel sexier when she was covered from head to toe in a black shroud. To borrow from the once world-famous but now largely discarded journalist Oriana Fallaci, she preferred not to wear a medieval rag or be forced to wear one when she was interviewing Ayatollah Khomeini back in the day, and said that. She was a bold lady. She did not think that the submission that is in fact really the purpose of this whole process, right, to submit to the will of what would be in any women's and gender studies class, it would be a patriarchal society. This would be male hegemony. This would be all the oppression that the feminists talk about that they say exists here that doesn't really. It exists in the Muslim world, and they don't want to talk about it. And this mentality of a man who at least holds himself up as some kind of an educator, again, going back to this Blaze story, that he would lay his hands in anger, that he would harm a 14-year-old girl because she wasn't wearing a hijab at class. Understand that this would be the case in many parts of the world, and he would be applauded for it. If someone's 14-year-old daughter in parts of Pakistan or Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia, or should I go on, parts of Egypt, you name it, we could do this all day. She didn't wear the hijab, and she was beaten to within an inch of her life by her parents, by her own father. It would be applauded. We know this. We know this is the case. And yet, not a lot of talk about it. Is this in conflict with Western values? Is physical harm against somebody for refusing to go the full beekeeper route, as I call it. And I say it with disdain. I don't say it haphazardly. I am disdainful of the full female covering that is prominent in many parts of the Muslim world. I am horrified at watching the shrouded ghosts, often in sort of a lapis blue color, with gauze over their eyes in Afghanistan. I saw it with my own eyes. I was around it. Women in tremendous heat and dust and filth wearing this giant blue tarp to dehumanize them. People say, oh, well, that's the most extreme example. Okay, well, you work your way down, and in a lot of other places, the purpose is basically the same. It is a form of female submission to a what would be called by the leftist feminists a modern patriarchal male hegemony, but we don't get to talk about it. We don't get to discuss it. Also know this, that the view of many devout Muslims in places around the world of women who don't cover is not, yeah, they just like blue jeans, you know, tomato, tomato. They've got their way, we've got our way. No, they think that you're essentially a harlot, if I can use a less harsh term for the same process, for the same description. I guess sort of Shakespearean, I guess. They think that you are a woman of low morals. And they want to impose this. And in fact, one of the best indicators of how Islamist and therefore also jihadist a society is, how much do the women cover? How much do they cover? People always hold up Turkey, right? Or Turkey and Indonesia are the two that prove that Islam, right? Turkey, the country that has a military that has rules in place for a secular government that will basically say, hey, if you guys get too Islamic, we will step in and get rid of this government, right? The country that will just sort of have a coup every now and again to make sure it doesn't get too Islamist. And it's getting increasingly Islamist, as we know, because of Erdogan and his AKP party and all the rest of it. But point you make there is, yeah, there's covering there. There's some women that are going with the full beekeeper. But you look at the other countries, and you look at the countries that are trying to be as Sharia compliant as they can in whatever way that they interpret that, and there's more and more covering. Now, is that analogous to being more and more Muslim, more and more religious? I think you could certainly make the case that that's true. Saudi Arabia, which is the closest thing Islam has to, you know, a Vatican and Rome, right? Mecca and Medina. Look how women are dressed there. Friends of mine who have spent a lot of time over there, who have lived over there, will talk about it. The mutawas, the religious police, will walk around and they will arrest you for showing hair in public, for very minor violations. I mean, this is medieval, backwards, insane stuff. But we're told that, oh, no, there's no problem with Islam and modernity whatsoever. It's all fine. There's no problem with Islam in the West whatsoever. It's all fine. Having been in some cities in Africa where you will see girls as young as 10 in full black abaya, head to toe, maybe their face covered, maybe not, 10 years old. They're not making this choice, walking around dressed like that all the time. Let me tell you something. It's hot. It's uncomfortable. No one cares. Forced to dress this way. Forced to not have a sense of self and their own identity, and to walk around constantly showing their submission to the male members of their household and later to their husband. That's what this is all about. It is just a tool for the oppression of women. And I'm not somebody who runs around, you know, raising the feminist flag all the time, because feminism has been hijacked by the left in this country to really just mean anti-male. And yet you won't hear them. You won't hear the most ardent feminists, the ones who not long ago, you know, burning bras and talking about how we need total equality and equal pay and everything, all that stuff that you'll hear when it comes to Islamic things. Oh, well, that's the way they do it, even if it's in this country. Well, you know, it's a cultural thing. No, it's more than a cultural thing. They view it as a moral choice. Therefore, they view the decision not to cover as an immoral choice, which is why in many societies they will take even corporal punishment as an option, as something that they will do to try to enforce these norms. This is deeply problematic. You know, people who think that you should be harmed because you don't want to wear the equivalent of a giant trash bag all the time, that's a problem for me. I have a problem with that. And people say, oh, well, they're choosing to do this. Well, yeah, you could raise kids to think any number of things, right? You could force people into any number of positions. But just think about how they actually treat women in their own societies and what the correlation is between how much of a woman has to be covered and how free that society is, how free the women in that society is, how much we would want to replicate parts of that society here. There are very important and very clear distinctions that we need to start making, because we have lost a sense of what is most precious and most desirable in our own society, in this country. The freedom to dress how you want to dress doesn't seem like a big deal until you realize that there are people out there who will punch young teenage girls. They'll strike them because they just want to dress like everybody else and be comfortable and not constantly have to submit, not constantly have to be under the boot heel of whatever the latest Islamist interpretation is of how women should dress. Yeah, there is a conflict between the West and Islam on issues like this. I think we should talk about it. Back in a minute.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton Show.
Team, the lines are open, 888-900-3393. We haven't talked in days. I missed you. Let's talk. Phone lines wide open. Also, Facebook.com/Buck Sexton. I posted that piece from The Federalist there. I've got some other stuff coming. At Buck Sexton on Twitter. Let's take Jake in North Carolina. Jake, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Buck. How's it going?
Good, sir. How are you?
Hey, man, I'm doing good. I was just wanting to talk to you real quick about the Colorado Springs shooter and get your response on this. You were saying earlier in the program that his motive certainly seemed to be targeting the people of Planned Parenthood, whether it be, you know, patients or employees of the Planned Parenthood facility. Early reports that I was reading, I'm not really sure where it came from. I believe it was Washington Post. Was so saying that the shooter wasn't targeting people of Planned Parenthood, that it happened outside of the building of Planned Parenthood. And then later, after the shootings were done, he ran inside of a Planned Parenthood building to, I guess, you know, take refuge there and hide out.
My understanding is that those initial reports you're referring to about that were updated with that was not the case, and the shooting was inside of Planned Parenthood. It looked like he was going after Planned Parenthood. I don't really see any other way to interpret it, quite honestly. If you can send me any links, if there's anything I'm missing, by all means. But the guy killed a bunch of people in a Planned Parenthood. It looks like he was targeting. I mean, when I say looks like, it seems rather obvious to me that he was targeting Planned Parenthood and was killing people inside there for whatever his internal motivations. We can get into some of those perhaps in more detail as we know more. But I'm just telling you what I've read, and my understanding is that those initial reports that involved a bank or it was outside were not in fact the case, and that he was inside of Planned Parenthood and was shit. Look, he shot, what was it? He killed three and shot nine. So
yeah, well,
whether it
happened anyways, as to whether, you know, what his motives were, the narrative has certainly been painted that it was indeed targeting Planned Parenthood. But, you know, I was just wanting to see your response as to whether what those early reports were true or false, or what the deal was with them.
Oh, no, I totally understand that. From what I've seen, it is clearly a targeting of he clearly was targeting Planned Parenthood. Look, there have been people who have killed abortion doctors in the past. There have been people who have, there was a bombing of an abortion clinic that is often referenced when people talk about right-wing terrorism. And I forget, it was in the 80s, I think. And I'm going off the top of my head. Maybe it was in the early 90s. It's a long time ago. That does happen. It is very, very rare, fortunately, as it should be. But this is the instance of where the extreme outlier, and I think this is what you're getting to, Jake, the extreme outlier will be used immediately to demonize people who not only have no interest in ever even pretending that this is tied to them or in some way they support this. They completely reject this. But it will be used to demonize all of the right, all of the pro-life movement, really all Christian churches that are pro-life as well. I mean, that's what will happen here. And it just goes to show you, you know, you have How many terrorist attacks on U.S. soil in the name of jihad? Nothing to do with Islam, of course. And then we get this going on. One guy every few decades attacks a Planned Parenthood clinic or an abortion doctor or whatever, an abortionist, whatever the case may be. And that is evidence of the way the right thinks about this, according to the left. It's just not true. It's dishonest. They know it's dishonest, but they also know that this is like a sacrament to them. You cannot. There's no part of the left wing base that is more important to the left than the pro-choice side of things. That's it.
All right. Well.
All right, man. Thank you for calling in. Yeah, look, the guy attacked the plane. We can call out the hypocrisy, but we always have to also make sure that we don't start to do anything that even begins to feel or smell a little bit like how the left plays the game with these things. We can say, yeah, okay, there's a guy who, passed out, the New York Times said he passed out some anti-Obama pamphlets at one point, right? So they're trying to make it seem. Look, it's a 50-50 proposition that you're either Democrat or Republican. There are going to be some people who have some tie, loose or otherwise. I know some of you are going to say, no, he's not a member of the GOP. I don't even care. It doesn't even matter. The guy's crazy. He attacked a Planned Parenthood clinic. He killed a bunch of people. And, it's probably a death penalty case, I would assume, unless he gets insanity. This may be a case where he can plead insanity, actually, and spend the rest of his life in an asylum because it seems like he is a deranged individual. But just because the left does this thing of, oh, we can't tell what the motive is, we don't know. We are honest. We call it how it is. And this, to me, I have no evidence to the contrary that this was anything but a shooting of people inside of Planned Parenthood. That the guy is crazy and everything else, yes, true. But let's just make sure that we are honest about it. Does it represent the pro-life movement? Of course not. Is it? Are there lots of people sitting? If you did a poll of pro-lifers, would they say, "Yeah, this is the way"? You'd be at zero. But this will be used the same way. By the way, people do this with every time there's some white guy somewhere who does something crazy and kills a bunch of people. If he says, "Yeah, Abraham Lincoln was my friend." Oh, Abraham Lincoln was a member of the Republican Party, and so clearly this is a GOP plot. This guy is part of the conservatism and everything. They'll do anything. They'll go to any lengths to sort of tie these things together, even when this is actually a crazy person. This is not somebody who's representative of a belief that has support around the world. Back in a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Is the Buck Sexton Show.
Phone lines are still open here, my friends. 888-900-3393. Give me a call. We should talk about whatever you feel like we should talk about. The lines here are wide open. I just want to make sure that I'm clear. I always try to be everything I say, I strive to always make sure that it's factual, and if I'm wrong, I always correct it whenever I find out that I'm wrong. Some of you are saying that the shooting at Planned Parenthood was only outside. And I'm looking here at CNN's write-up of it, and it says that where did we go here? He gave himself up to he surrendered in a hallway. This is what it says. The siege ended Friday when the suspect dropped his gun and surrendered in a hallway once a SWAT team brought in a Bearcat armored vehicle. And Deere was cornered. So, I'm assuming he was inside the building. For those of you, because I'm seeing some people saying that it was only outside and not inside the facility, but that would seem to be not the case. If I am wrong, send me a link, let me know. But it says that he gave himself up in a hallway. So that would be inside. But I'm still making, there was a lot. It's tough with these things sometimes. A lot of initial early reports. And you've got to pay close attention. The news outlets, it's not irresponsible of them, but they're just giving you breaking news sometimes. And sometimes breaking news needs to be updated with additional facts as it comes out. All right. Doug in Atlanta, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Good afternoon, Buck. Good to speak to you again. Long time since the Saturday show.
Oh, great. Thank you. Original Squad, thank you so much for being with me in the Freedom Hut, Doug. I appreciate it. What's on your mind?
It was an excellent breakdown on the Islamist regarding the 14-year-old girl. That was fantastic.
You.
Understanding, you know, people don't understand free choice and imposed sanctions, religion. You know, they want to get upset with everybody else, but when the Muslims, you know, it's hands off.
Well, when it comes to modern American feminists, they won't, they will not. And by the way, it's not only this kind of repression of females is a problem. This is a problem in the Indian subcontinent. This is a problem in Hindu majority areas of India as well. There's a lot of oppression of women in the developing world that is considered under the sort of broad umbrella of cultural differences. Right. This is what we refer to as moral relativism on display. And American feminists, in particular, Western feminists, I should say, are just appalling on this issue. They're like, oh, yeah, so they have to. And one of the places, Doug, where, you know, historically we point to, we say, no, there is something that is good and there is something that is bad. There is evil and there is good in the world. And cultural differences can't just be used as a catch-all to explain these things away. Would be sati, which was the pre-British colonial Indian practice of burning a wife on a funeral pyre. So if you were a widow, if your husband died, they would burn you on a funeral pyre, right? They would light you on fire on a funeral pyre. And if you were a woman, because you no longer had value in that society, the British, yes, the imperialist British came in and said, sorry, not gonna allow this practice anymore. This is barbaric and grotesque. You won't often, you know, they won't teach you about that one in school. Anyway, Doug, what else you got on your mind?
I do have to take you to task on one of your comments regarding Obama and the Planned Parenthood shooting. You said that Obama was immediately calling for gun control. In the South, we have a saying. It's called, duh. That's like playbook page 101. Very, very beginning, first thing you do is demonize, send it out broad spectrum, and put in a sense of urgency. It has to be done right now.
I'm all okay with Doug with anyone on TBA calling me to task, but I think that's what I was saying is that he went to it right.
Just immediately. Yep. But it almost the way you brought it up was almost a sense of surprise.
So. Oh, well let me that, okay, there's a point of clarification here that I think then would be in order. What I meant to say is that you would think that the first focus would be on for purely propagandistic messaging purposes. I would think that the media would do the look at the right. This is representative of the right. This is the pro-life movement on display for you. This lunatic killing innocent people. And they would focus only on that because of this is a rare, you know, this is, they get a rare chance here to go after the pro-life movement by trying to tarnish them by demonizing the pro-life movement. Right. But Obama also put guns into it right away. And you could say that you would expect that. But if you're looking at this from a propaganda and messaging perspective from the left, I would have thought maybe they give that the first they go after the pro-life movement and then they introduce the issue of guns a day or two later. But they went for it both right away. So exactly. You could say that you would expect that. And you would have been right because that's what happened. I would have thought that at first it's demonization of the pro-life movement. Then guns is a secondary issue for them because they actually understand this, Doug. In the hierarchy of leftist hatred, pro-life is above pro-Second Amendment. They hate pro-life people. The hard left in this country, the statist authoritarian left, hates pro-lifers more than they hate people who believe in the right to bear arms under the Constitution. So that's kind of my, that was, I'm sorry?
But why wait? We can kill two birds with one stone.
Well, Doug, they definitely went for them both at the same time, and the Obama administration did not wait. Thanks for calling in from Atlanta, my friend, and thank you for being a listener since the old Saturday show, which, yeah, that's great that I've had people went with me. And if this is your first show listening to, thank you. Welcome. Team Buck welcomes you. I welcome you. We'll talk a little about maybe Thanksgiving in a minute. I got a couple of bits more of business here that I wanted to touch on. First of all, I mentioned sort of offhand the American feminist writer who had written a piece that got a lot of attention. This is back in 2008. Naomi Wolf, I thought that's who it was, but I didn't want to misstate it on air, wrote a piece, Behind the Veil, meaning the hijab, lives a thriving Muslim sexuality. So essentially, behind the veil, things are sexy. Now, I know they'll point to wealthy women in Saudi Arabia who shop at you know, agent provocateur, or they shop at Victoria's Secret and all this sort of thing for their husbands. And this is always used as a C underneath there. It's, you know, it's just like, I don't know, it's just like you would expect it to be. But that's just, I mean, come on. Go into poor parts of Muslim countries, and this is used very obviously as a means to oppress women. And if it's not always, this is from the LA Times, somebody actually calling out, a female writer calling out Naomi Wolf for this piece from years ago, which was pretty widely ridiculed, about how it's sexy to, it's essentially, it's sexy to wear the hijab, and the hijab made her feel, the hijab is sexy. You know, the full beekeeper makes women feel sexy. Doesn't make them feel like they're property, doesn't make them feel like, and oh, by the way, another important point here that I did not make before about this, and I actually, just so we can put this all out there, I studied in college this specific issue. I actually spent a semester in a course called Islamic Constructions of Gender. We spent a ton of time on the hijab, the veil, all the different iterations of it, everything. So it was a Muslim professor, very smart guy, very leftist guy, and it was me and a bunch of women in gender studies majors. I don't want to misstate. I think I was the only guy in the class, or might have been one other guy in the class. And then a bunch of what they called them WAGs, Women in Gender Studies, was the acronym was WAGs, which was a course of study for undergrads at Amherst. You could be a WAGs major. This is also the school that has to get rid of the British colonial mascot that nobody paid attention to anyway, because, you know, hashtag imperialism, hashtag oppression. This was something I've studied and paid close attention to for a long time, and understand that also. And I know this is, it depends on the country. Yeah, but this is widespread stuff. There are a lot of, I could sit here and start rattling off countries where this is the case. There is one of the rationales for dressing women in the Muslim world in this way is so that they do not subject men to the temptation of catching a little too much ankle out of the corner of their eye. You know what I'm saying? You know, hey, you see a little lower calf there. Ooh. But it's actually a deadly serious issue, because what they really mean by that, you know, at first you're like, yeah, whatever, right? I mean, men, temptation. No, what they really mean by that is women who are not dressed that way, and this is true in many Muslim countries, look at the prescription for what is required for a rape prosecution under Sharia. You have to have witnesses to the act, other than the woman, whose testimony does not count for as much as a man's. Well, guess what? Not a lot of rape prosecutions are going to happen there. But also, failure to dress in the prescribed Islamic fashion is essentially an incitement to sexual violence against women. That is the underlying truth within many of these Islamic societies. What they're really saying is, you know how you used to hear this thing, and now this is used as a point of snide ridicule for various things. People say, "Oh, you mean to say her skirt was too short?" Which you say as a means of saying that anyone who would justify any act that came from that is a barbarian, a criminal, and has, you know, that's irrelevant. It's irrelevant how short a woman's skirt is. You don't get to make any choices that violate the law, that violate that woman or her dignity or anything based on the length of her skirt, right? This is now, in society, we've reached this point where, you know, you don't get to bring that up at a trial. You don't get to say, oh, well, you know, she was wearing this. No, sorry. Doesn't fly. But in many Islamic societies, in fact, that would be considered completely acceptable as a means of defense against, for example, a sexual assault. And keep in mind that they're not talking about a skirt being too short. They're talking about her hair was showing. Can't handle it. Her hair was showing. It was just too much for me. And when I was looking for this piece with Naomi Wolf here, you have this LA Times piece. These are from a few years ago. I could find more recent ones, but I'm just doing some quick Google research in the break here. On Monday in Sudan, Lubna Hussein, a 34-year-old journalist, was convicted and jailed for wearing pants, long, loose pants, on the streets of Khartoum in Sudan. Though she was released the next day, she avoided the 40 lashes with a plastic whip that is considered a standard sentence for wearing, quote, indecent clothing under Sudanese law. They'll beat you if you wear pants. This isn't Sudan. This isn't Saudi. There's many places. But hey, it's not a problem, right, guys? Totally compatible with Western values. Feminism is alive and well in the Islamic world, they will tell you. And most of the time, they're lying. Back in a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Discover more at theblaze.com/radio.
The Blaze Radio Network. Sexton Show.
Well, you've got, of course, none other than John McCain weighing in to say that Trump's rhetoric makes Muslims around the world hate us. Play that clip, please.
Donald Trump, when he talks about registering Muslims in the United States, does that have any real effect outside of the United States in the fight against the ISIS?
Oh, I think it has an interesting effect of turning Muslims all over the world against the United States of America, which is 99.44% people who practice an honorable religion.
I always think it's fascinating. And of course, I look, registering people based on their religion is un-American. We shouldn't do that. I actually was happy to see that Ted Cruz came out right away and said, you know, that's ridiculous. And look, you know. Donald Trump does not yet speak for America. That much is true. We can say that. But I just also wanted to point out that there is this obsession in the media in this country with Democrats and even some Republicans to always seem to think that there's a root cause of jihadist murder and mayhem and terror and destruction, a root cause that we are both responsible for and could do something about. You know, we're always worried, oh, why do we're look around the world, Muslims hate. Look, people are worried about what they're around the world are worried about, how they're gonna, you know, keep food on the table, pay their bills, keep a roof over their head. That's what most people are worried about everywhere. Those who are a part of what could be broadly termed the global jihad, for example, either actively as fighters or just people who support it or believe in it, they're going to hate America whether Donald Trump says something that's over the line or not. But I just am always on guard for this. It's a constant refrain you'll hear. It's sort of a version of the why do they hate us? Why does ISIS hate us? And I always want to point out, it's not why does ISIS hate us. It's why does ISIS hate us? Why does Jamaat Islamiya hate us? Why does Al-Qaeda hate us? Why does the Muslim Brotherhood hate us? Why does Hamas hate us? Why does Hezbollah hate us? We're going to be here for a long time talking about all the different groups that hate us. And then add to that, why do the millions of Muslims in various countries around the world who support actively or passively those groups, why do they hate us? And when you start to sit and think about it, you realize, oh, wait a second. The only way we can make that hatred stop is if we submit too. They'll always find something. There is always a pretext, whether it's a ban on headscarves in France, or it's the legacy of colonialism because of Sykes-Picot in the Middle East, or our support for Israel, which of course is a huge one. Literally, our support for Israel's right to exist. That's a pretext for violence. They will always, a cartoon made by some Danish cartoonist. There's always a pretext. They always have a pretext for violence. So I'm not worried about why do they hate us? The people who hate us, the people who are too stupid to say, well, you know, Donald Trump said something that, I don't support. But, you know, I'm a person who believes in the dignity and the sanctity of life and individuals and everything else, whatever my religion or belief system is. They're not going to start hating us because of what Donald Trump says. But, oh, we always have to be so sensitive to this. Oh, why do they hate us? Why does the Muslim world hate us? And a better question, maybe we should start just saying, hey, guys, you know, we've got some good ideas over here, and it's produced some good stuff, too, like computers and antibiotics and other good things, like such as, back in a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
spreading freedom across the nation. This is
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut for Hour 3. I've got a lot to talk to you about. The phone lines are still open, 888-900-3393. Here we go again. So Dr. Ben Carson, who has had a rough few weeks when it comes to the media's version of Dr. Ben Carson, right? He's had a few, and there have been a few missteps, obviously. And he's pretty much a political novice, and he's going to make some mistakes here and there, but the mistakes are always amplified dramatically by the media. And he visited over the Thanksgiving holiday. He visited the refugee camps in Jordan. I want to check and make sure that I'm giving you the right. Which refugee camp was he in? I mean, it looks just like Zaatari where I was. And I assume that it is Zaatari based on the photos I'm seeing here, but I'm not. It's just saying refugee camp. It's not giving me a specific, because there are several very large ones, actually. But Dr. Carson has come back and he said numerous things about this. He said they need a lot more help. The refugees need a lot more help, which is certainly true. And it is a difficult thing to walk around and see people living in that level of despair and deprivation. I've seen worse than what's in the refugee camps for people who weren't even in camps. They just were in incredibly poor places. I mean, at least the refugee camps, they do have access to clean water. There's some basic medical care available. They aren't under threat of imminent murder and rape and mutilation, as they obviously, the refugees are, if they had stayed in parts of Syria. But Dr. Carson is over there and he's saying that they need a lot more help. But then he also said that they want to go back home. And that's actually the preference for many of the. Now, look, when you say they, it depends on who you're asking about. But there are there's a serious portion or proportion of refugees who want to go back to Syria at some point. And he raised this. Play clip 3.
I was very pleasantly surprised to see how welcoming they are. I had an opportunity to talk to many of the Syrian refugees and ask them, what is your supreme desire? And it was pretty uniform. They want to go back home, obviously. And I said, what kinds of things could a nation like the United States do that would be helpful to you? And again, I was a little bit surprised with the answer, because it wasn't what we're hearing a lot. We're hearing that they all want to come here to the United States, and that's not what they want. They want to go back home. But they said the United States and other nations could be much more supportive of the Herculean efforts manifested by the Jordanians in taking in people at a lot of expense to themselves.
You know, I always think there's a lot here that I want to work through with you. First of all, it is kind of fascinating that the Jordanians, who are the Jordanian regime, King Hussein, are a very close U.S. ally in the region, which is not. People don't always think of it in those terms, but Jordan is a very close U.S. ally and is reasonable and helpful on a number of issues that are important to the United States. One of the places where Jordan has been most helpful is on refugees. And Jordan has turned into a sort of de facto pressure valve for much of the rest of the Middle East, whereby Palestinian refugees have been taken into Jordan with some problems in the past. Iraqi refugees from the Iraq War have been taken into Jordan, and now Syrian refugees have been taken into Jordan. But the Jordanians don't want to make them all citizens of Jordan. And no one ever says, oh, Jordan's racist or xenophobic. No, they just don't want to have to deal with creating the infrastructure and dealing with a traumatized population of non-Jordanians. Jordan's kind of like, look, we'll keep these people safe for a period of time, but we're not about to say that they're Jordanians themselves, right? We've got our own thing going on here. We've got our own problems. And that's, look, we're just happy that they're taking in the refugees in the first place. But I do think it's interesting that you don't hear accusations of, you know, why can't Turkey just let all these refugees become citizens? Why can't Jordan let all these refugees become citizens? Is it because they're xenophobic? Is it because they're hateful? They hate refugees? No. They're allowed to inquire and worry about the costs and worry about the cultural cohesion. Yeah, that's right. Syrian refugees speak Arabic. They don't speak Turkish. So, for example, there's an issue there. It doesn't mean that they can't overcome that. I'm sure there are plenty of Assyrian refugees who have either a very basic or even perhaps a proficient knowledge of Turkish, those who are close to the border, who come from northern Syria. But irrespective of all that, at least those countries, Jordan and Syria, are allowed, I mean, it's Jordan and Turkey, rather, are allowed to say, you know, we're not taking them in forever. We're going to keep them from, you know, we're humanitarians, but we also, we're trying to run a country here. And that's just considered okay. The world isn't pressuring those countries to absorb these hundreds of thousands, millions, in fact, of refugees. But in America, we had this huge debate over 10,000 refugees. By the way, where did that debate go? What happened there? Oh, was that just a deflection in the aftermath of President Obama saying that ISIS is contained the same day that there's a huge mass casualty attack that kills 130 Parisians, wounds hundreds more? Was that just a media deflection? Oh, yeah, I think it was. A deeply cynical deflection of attention away from something that was very obviously damaging, not just for President Obama, but for the Democratic Party, and therefore, yes, for Queen Hillary's chances as well. The Empress Hillary, already crowned, just waiting to take her seat. So that was all of it. Whenever we talk about refugees, and I've been there, as you know, I've talked to you about this before, and the refugees that I spoke to, of course, when I say spoke to, it was through an interpreter, because there was very limited English for a vast majority of the refugees that I was able to speak to. But they said the same thing. They said that they want to return home. It's fascinating to me. Return home to Syria. Fascinating to me that the way the media reports this with Dr. Carson, first of all, they don't call him doctor. Ben Carson. You know, hey, Benny Carson. You know, Ben Carson. Ben Carson, is he an auto repair guy? Oh, no, he's chief of pediatric brain surgery at Johns Hopkins University Hospital. But, you know, it's Ben Carson. Let's not call him Dr. Carson. Isn't it fascinating, by the way? I've already talked to you about the Dr. Jill Biden PhD in education or whatever versus the Dr. Ben Carson, who gets more doctors in the media. We've talked about that before. But I do think it's fascinating that, you know, the moment that you don't call somebody who held some cronyist from the Clinton administration or from any administration, to be fair, Bush, anyone else, with some of these people, it tends to be Democrats, though. Whatever. Some of them, if you don't call them ambassador because they held like their ambassador to the Bahamas or something at some point because they raised money for the campaign. Call me ambassador. You know, even when they haven't been ambassador in years, they get all huffy about it. Meanwhile, you go to med school for 4 years. You're a resident for years after that. You spend your whole life achieving the title of doctor, real doctor, like medical doctor. And either it's doctorate in science and stuff too. I guess some of you got mad at me. I mean, if you have a PhD in microbiology, I am very impressed. You are a doctor. Okay. But, you know, a PhD in phys ed? Are you really Dr. Phys Ed? I don't know. I mean, I guess you could be. You know, are you like really that good at setting up the cones for floor hockey? Or dodgeball? Okay, so back to Dr. Carson. He says this. He says that the refugees want to return to Syria, and the way that it's portrayed is that this is all, look at this ignoramus on foreign policy. And it's subtle. I'm not saying it this because there are some right-wing outlets that have also kind of just said, yeah, he comes back and says this. But you'll see the way that this is portrayed, the way that they talk. They could come in and say, Dr. Carson says refugees in Syria want to go back to Syria, and then add a few paragraphs of context to that, policy context, meaning that what this leads to is a discussion as to whether the best policy would be to improve conditions, which is what Dr. Carson's actually trying to say, improve conditions in the camps, work on defeating ISIS with a real strategy, with real international muscle put behind the effort, with the U.S. actually leading. Now, I know that's not going to happen, but this is why the Republicans are talking about this, because it's not going to happen and it should be happening. But to provide them better conditions such that they want to return to Syria. Resettling them in Sweden or Germany or America is not necessarily the answer. And it depends on which case we're talking about, depends on the numbers and everything else. This is, you know, he's trying to have an adult discussion and start a serious policy discussion as to what's best with refugees. But you'll notice they don't add those layers of context. It's just Dr. Ben Carson says refugees want to go back to Syria. I guess he's too dumb to notice that there's a war going on there. That's the subtext. They're just letting it hang out there. Dr. Ben Carson, Syrian refugees want to return home. As I told you, they told me the same thing. They do want to return home. They want their country back. And on top of that, you'll just see there's not a lot of effort to try to shape this into a meaningful point of policy debate. Instead, it's just, oh, yeah, that Ben Carson guy just talking about refugees and how they want to go home. It is amazing to see this. You know, there was this part of me that sort of hoped that in the aftermath of President Obama's election, particularly the first time around, when the media was, I was embarrassed for them. They're like, oh, Barack Obama. I mean, they were like a bunch of, across the board with a few, with some exceptions in terms of networks and papers that have, you know, real following and a real voice. This is pre the Blaze, right? 2008. And they acted like fangirls who had seen the Beatles for the first time with Barack Obama. And it was embarrassing. It was unseemly. It was an abdication of professional and ethical responsibility. And I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you all this, but I had points. And this is before I worked in media. So the CIA, I was like, well, this will be too far, right? There'll be a corrective now of some kind. There must be a desire for the media to get back the journalistic integrity that it lost by being obvious partisans in a way that not only transgressed their stated boundaries of not being people who have a political affiliation, which is obviously a lie, right? And as 90% of journalists in this country are left. But even beyond that, were unwilling to do, not only were they partisans, but they were unwilling to do their jobs as journalists. So they were cheerleaders and they wouldn't actually do vetting. They wouldn't look into the background. They wouldn't talk about it. They would shut it down. And it was such a totally unacceptable state of affairs if you believe that there is something, if there are ethics in media, if that does exist. I thought that maybe that this would sort of change. Maybe we'd reach a point where this wouldn't be quite as blatant and obvious. Nope. Nope. That was years ago. And all I've seen since then is that they're just transferring over. Obama mania has transferred over into, you know, ready for Hillary. It's just the same darn thing all over again. When was the last time you heard a negative story about the Clinton Foundation reported by any major media outlet? You don't think there's anything there? There could be a media outlet just devoted to doing that every day, looking into all the dealings. Why isn't it a matter of public record exactly how many dollars the Clinton Foundation raised and exactly how many dollars the Clinton Foundation spent on actual charitable work, not paying salaries, not sending people around in private jets, on actual charity, real charity? Those numbers should be out there. They should be repeated time and time again. We should all know them and have access to them. And I'm sure you could find them, but not going to find them on the front page of the New York Times. Not going to find them in the Washington Post. Isn't that relevant? Shouldn't that be relevant? These people are raising $1 billion. What have they done? What good has been done in their name? I really think we have a right to know this. In fact, I know we have a right to know this. There are laws about transparency for charitable foundations, for 501c3 groups, or 501c4s, or whatever the Clinton Foundation falls under. I think it's a 501c3, but all of them, they have transparency requirements. No, you won't have any of that vetting, but you just have the constant, as we see with Dr. Carson, goes out to the refugee camps, is trying to make a valid point about policy with refugees, and there's just this constant undermining all the time. Sometimes subtle, sometimes overt. It's just one of the reasons why I tip my hat to all these guys on the Republican side of the aisle that are in any way a real contender. Like, I don't think Jim Gilmore is, you know, handling all the heat. But I tip my hat to the other contenders because they're just up against it every single day. And, you know, they're not trying to give Hillary a lead in the polls, solely do that. They're actually trying to destroy the reputations of these men and women with Carly Fiorina. They're trying to destroy reputations. They're trying to destroy a life's work. They're trying to convince people. The media is actively trying to convince the American public right now that Dr. Ben Carson raised by a single mother in Detroit, one of many children, did it all on his own, became chief pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins University Hospital, first in history to successfully separate conjoined twins. They're trying to convince you that this man is stupid. That's what they're trying to do. Let that sink in for a minute. All right, we'll take a break here. I'll be right back.
Buck Sexton, dispensing the truth.
On the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
Team 888-900-3393 on our phone lines. I just want to say I hope you all had a moment here to sort of just stretch out for a second. I know we've talked a lot of intense stuff today. I hope you all had a great Thanksgiving. Mama Sexton, my mom, amazing turkey and a phenomenal feast prepared. There were seven of us. Six after day one, who were feasting, and we thought we had enough food for like a week. This is what always happens, and we consumed all leftovers within 24 hours. The only problem I have right now is I feel a bit like Jabba the Hutt, you know, just like blah, blah, blah. Because as I learn more about it, there's not, technically speaking, a sort of glycemic index loophole for Thanksgiving, and so if you eat like a gallon or two of stuffing, and then you pile on all the turkey and everything else you got going on, and then of course pumpkin pie. What are you going to do? You're going to not eat the pumpkin pie? You're going to not just let it rip and eat some pumpkin pie? That's just crazy talk. But now I do feel sort of like I'm going to be joining everybody else who this week is just running into the gym and working out until they almost pass out because they realize that if they don't, they're going to have to invest in a new wardrobe after a Thanksgiving feast. It was delicious. It was amazing. I got to walk around also upstate in the property in the woods and see some horses and some burros or donkeys. Wild donkeys are called burros. So I got to play with some of the fun stuff upstate. We'll play a little tennis. Anyway, it was nice. I had a really good time. But I do feel like a large sedated zoo animal, like I've been hit with a dart or something, you know, and I'm pretty slowed down. What was it? I think that was Kevin James years ago who said that after he ate a Big Mac or something like that, he felt like a grizzly bear that had been hit with a tranquilizer dart. I'm still kind of in that food coma state of wow, Thanksgiving feast. So anyway, gonna have to eat a lot of kale this week and try to get back on task. But I hope you had a really good time with family members and had some interesting political discussions. Maybe even had the opportunity, just putting this out there, maybe even had the opportunity to say, hey, there's this guy who does a radio show every day for 3 hours. It's totally free. It's digital. You can listen to it wherever you are. You carry the device in your pocket. Your smartphone is your radio for this radio show, or your computer, your laptop, your iPad. And you can listen to him. And sometimes he's really great, and sometimes he's only a little great, maybe. I don't know, whatever you want to say, but I do appreciate all of the above. And if you get the chance, please do continue. Every time somebody sends me a message on Facebook or on Twitter, and they're like, hey, I got another member of team, it's like that's just music to my ears, or my eyes, I guess, because I'm reading it. But I really appreciate it, because you are the eyes and ears of this show. I mean, you're the ones who can spread the word, all of you listening. So, and I know it sounds like, really, if every person listening to this got one person to tune in to the Freedom Hut in the next 2 weeks who's new, I mean, we're just going to be crushed. People be like, oh my gosh, they're taking over the country. It'd be amazing. So just please keep that in mind. Anyway, I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I'm going to come back in just a second.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton.
Team, we are joined now by our guest and a friend of the show, Madison Jezziotto. She's a columnist for the Washington Times. She has a personal story about what it's like to be on campus and be a conservative these days that she's going to share with us. Madison, thank you so much for calling in, and I hope you had a great Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Buck. I'm glad to be back with you today.
So I haven't had a chance yet to talk to the members of Team Buck about exactly what's going on here at all. So you're going to have to take us to the beginning with this piece that you wrote for the Washington Times, where you're a columnist, the number one killer of Black Americans. Walk us through a little bit of the piece and then the reaction and the current controversy.
Absolutely. So just over a month ago, I wrote a column, the number one killer of Black Americans. And of course, that is abortion. This is something that is not new. It's been spoken about by leaders all across the world for many years. Pope Francis recently obviously reaffirmed abortion as the taking of a human life, and especially Ohio leaders have spoken a lot about this. And Ohio leaders from the Black community are former Ohio Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell, and also outside of that, 2016 presidential candidate Dr. Ben Carson. Very simple, short piece. My statistics came straight from the CDC, showing that Black women are having abortions at very high rates, and, you know, I'm trying with this piece to bring social awareness to a very important issue in today's society. But of course, as a second-year law student at Ohio State, I received the complete opposite response as what I should have received for this piece. The name-calling and bullying, of course, immediately started within the students. Shortly after that, one student crossed the line and posted a very ambiguous threat on my Facebook page saying, "The government may not be able to take action against me, but they can take action against me." Now, of course, I did not know this student. I didn't know what type of action that she and these other students planned to take. All I wanted for the university to do was to take 5 short minutes to investigate this threat and make sure that this was not a physical action. So I made an appointment immediately to go down to the dean's office. I called. They said I could come in immediately. 15 minutes later, I get there. Instead of just the dean that I
scheduled. Wait, Madison, wait. Slow down for one second. Give me 1 sec. So everyone's up to speed. So you write this piece. You write this column about.
Yes.
The number one killer of Black Americans, which you state in the piece, is abortion. And as you've said, this is an argument that other people have made, or this is rather a point that other people have made, that there is a disproportionate impact on the Black community from abortions. Okay, so you write this piece. You have student outcry, which that I think a lot of people would expect on the modern campus. But then you have somebody with an ambiguous threat. Now you're concerned for your safety as a student at Ohio State University. Now you go to meet with the deans, who at these schools are generally very concerned with safe spaces for people and safety on campus and a safe environment on campus. And okay, what do the deans say to you, Madison?
So instead of taking my threat seriously, they immediately spend 1 hour. And now keep in mind, like I said, I scheduled a meeting with one dean. 10 minutes later when I got there, there were 3 deans waiting for me. They had my article in front of them. They clearly had been preparing for this for a lot longer than those 10 minutes. They attacked my piece for about an hour, continually expressing how my faith-based beliefs on abortion and how this article could harm my legal career, could harm my ability to write as a staff editor for the Ohio State Journal of Criminal Law. They claimed that maybe because everybody doesn't know what a staff editor is, that I should remove that from my biography, which is the most absurd argument that I've ever heard. On top of that, they just continued to badger me, saying that this was a horrible article, it wasn't a good journalistic piece, it wasn't a good legal piece, and I never requested their advice on my writing for work, which of course is not at all associated with the university or any of my classes or professors there, so it was completely unwarranted and inappropriate on their part.
So you had 3 deans. So you sit down with the deans of your university, or 3 deans from your university. You have a safety concern, and they take this as an opportunity not to address that and not even to reaffirm your First Amendment rights to write a column that discusses this issue, but they pull it apart and also tell you, oh, by the way, you should change what's on your resume. That's what went down.
Yeah, well, what's on, they specifically refer to my biography on the Washington Times website, and that's what they were referring to, kind of just encouraging me to take off my association with the school. And I said, you know, we're not saying you can't be a student here. We just, you know, want to make sure everybody understands. It was absolutely inappropriate. On top of that, they claimed that this article looks to be a piece directly attacking Black Lives Matter. And that is obviously not at all what the piece was. If you read the piece, that wasn't even referenced in the column. So it's been over a month now. The threat has not been looked into. I've never heard back from the dean that I scheduled the meeting with. And when I did send a follow-up two emails to these deans, the first one was with copies of the threat and all of the information they requested. The second one was saying, hey, like, you know, my anxieties continue to rise. I haven't heard back from you. What's going on? I received an email back from one of the other deans that I did not schedule a meeting with, saying, and she, by the way, is the advisor of the Black Law Students Association at my law school. She says she's talked to the members of the Black Law Students Association and to people like that were involved in commenting online, and she doesn't feel there's a threat for my safety. Now, let's keep in mind the threat I reported was from a white woman at the law school who is not a member of the Black Law Students Association.
Right. So they've done nothing. They've ignored all. They've ignored all this for in terms of your safety and that concern. But how have other students on campus? Have you had any further issues with students sort of trying to ostracize you or criticize you or threaten you, or has it died down a bit?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if anything, it's continued to escalate. And, you know, instead of arguing on merits of this column, these students are continuing to attempt to delegitimize me by branding me as a racist and a bigot. And obviously that's not the case. We live in a country where facts on campuses have become less important than feelings. And these illiberal leftist students are hunting down defenders of their views. They're attempting to silence them. And they're attempting to use these students that they silence as examples in order to silence others. And, you know, I'm just not going to be silenced. This is a very important issue, and I'm not going to back down because of these students bullying me and these administrators bullying me.
Now, do you have a piece where you make your case about all this in the Washington Times, or are you planning to write one?
Yeah, so I actually just last week on Wednesday released my follow-up column called Standing Up for the First Amendment, where I'm talking about, you know, who I am as a person, why this issue is important to me, and just how inappropriate their actions were. And obviously other news outlets have written about this as well, and what happened.
Yes, the Drudge Report, right before the holiday, the Drudge Report, I think, linked your column, or at least linked a reference to your column.
Yes, they linked the article written in the Washington Times referencing what happened, written by Valerie Richardson. On top of that, I've been very grateful to receive a ton of support from people who have read my column as well as the follow-up article on all ends of the political spectrum, reaching out and saying, you know, some people even said, I don't agree with you on anything politically. However, I do respect your right to be able to write your column and, you know, not have to worry about this type of treatment from your university. And some people were just disgusted by what happened and how I was treated.
All right. Well, Madison, we'll direct people to go read your latest at the Washington Times. Madison Jesiotto, always good to talk to you. Thank you for giving us a ring today, and keep in touch with us on this issue. Let us know how it continues on, or if it's resolved, or anything that happens.
Absolutely. Thanks for bringing me on.
All right, Madison. Talk soon. The phone lines are open, everybody. 888-900-3393. Back in just a minute.
Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Seeing the phone lines here are open, 888-900-3393. If you get a chance, please do tune in tonight at 7 Eastern to the Buck Sexton Show, the Freedom Hut TV show that we do here on the Buck Sexton Show. Check it out. I wanted to tell you that, you know, I was talking to Ty, who sometimes you'll hear me reference Ty. You can't hear what Ty and I are talking sometimes during the show and in breaks. Ty is one of our esteemed board operators. Ty runs the board, makes sure the show is all together. We get audio. Everything else is working, right? So we were just talking in the break. Ty is like, look, Ty was saying, I'm black. I read Madison's article, and I found no fault in it. It's just a lot of statistics, and she's making an argument. And I said to Ty, I said, you know, Ty, isn't it fascinating that and disheartening is a much better word than fascinating. I mean, isn't it disheartening that within the black community and also within modern liberalism and the left more broadly, to openly advocate for more black babies to be born and raised by their families and become, you know, to become human beings with the rest of us and citizens and our friends and neighbors and coworkers, to advocate for more black babies to be born and have lives is considered somehow racist, is considered somehow by certain groups. And I mean that by groups. I mean that there are organized entities, right? And Planned Parenthood being one of them. I mean, there are others as well that believe very strongly that there's that you to pull to point out these statistics is somehow evidence of racism, right? And, you know, there's NARAL, there's all these groups. And then there's, of course, sort of ethnic front groups that will take this position as well. And it's like, hold on a second. Let's all step back. So now if I say, or not I, or anyone, right? If one says, you know, the rate of abortion within urban black communities is something that is a terrible tragedy, and we should do all that we should make more resources available to, you know, mothers in, you know, to expectant mothers in crisis. We should do everything we can so that there are more black babies born instead of aborted. That's a racist position. I think of what a perversion of logic and morality that is. And someone like Madison writes this piece, and she's brave to make the argument, but keep in mind that others make the argument too, or it's not even really an argument. They're really just pointing out something. And this is what I was talking to Ty about. And Ty says, you know, I was reading it. Statistics, she's saying. The statistics for how many African-American children are aborted in New York City versus born are staggeringly high. And people who stand up and say, we need to do something about this. We need to do something about abortion and more children being born than aborted and across the board, right? But if you're looking at places in communities where this is a pandemic of death, it would seem within the black community you have there's so much that could be done, so much that should be done, and this should be a focus, and this should be that life should be promoted within this community in every way possible. And yet to do so is racist or is insensitive or is anti Black Lives Matter. No, this is a complete inversion of what's going on here. Black Lives Matter. And so more black babies should be born. And we should be promoting this, and we should be doing what we can as a society, as a community, as a country, as a nation, as a people to promote this. More born. It would be great if all could be born, but at least more born, right? I mean, let's do what we can. Let's save as many lives as we can. Let's have this conversation. That's right. Black Lives Matter. And so you want to tell me about how we can't talk about abortion in the black community? It is just unfathomable. It really is. And it shows you the lengths that people are willing to go to. And Madison, who is, you know, a young woman in law school, you know, we've had her on the Glenn Beck program when I guest hosted. She's an up and coming editorial writer for The Washington Times. And, you know, she's feeling real uncomfortable. She feels like she's under threat, and she goes to the deans and they essentially spit in her face, metaphorically speaking. And want to tear apart her position. Her position being, you know what would be really great? If we could at least lower the rate of abortion in the black community so that we could have more of our African-American, of our black American brothers and sisters, husbands, fathers, wives, born. Instead of, wouldn't that be nice? Isn't that a worthy goal? No, that's according to some of these groups, according to some of these, that's to say that is racist. The world is on its head. I don't know what to say. Tim in Arizona, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
I didn't get to hear your whole show yet today, so I'm jumping right in, maybe off topic. I'm curious, and I want to get your feedback on why nobody's calling this an assassination. When you actually go and look up the definition of assassination, it simply says, to kill someone or such a famous or important person, usually for political reasons. What's your
what are you referring to as an assassination?
This guy going into the Planned Parenthood and trying to take as many people out as he could.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you could call it, you know, usually an assassination, and now we're just getting into semantics. Usually an assassination is for political purposes, and therefore a political figure is targeted. That tends to be how people deploy the term assassination. But no, I mean, this was an act of terror. So, I mean, you could say that, right?
Glenn Beck has certainly been saying on his show that, you know, we're back in 1968. The only thing that's missing now is a few assassinations.
Well, I certainly hope that does not happen and that is not the case. But we got our eyes open. Tim from Arizona, thank you. Thank you for calling in. Tomorrow, I was going to say, tomorrow maybe we'll get some lighter news. We can talk some politics tomorrow, but no, I'm going to talk to you probably about ISIS tomorrow and the latest with that, because we didn't get into a buck brief today, and I've got a lot to say to all of you from the weekend. I've been reading up on all of this, and there's much to work on just in that sector tomorrow. So, team, I'm already thinking about tomorrow's show. As I said, please download today's show. Even if you're listening live, download it. I appreciate it. Share it with a friend. Send it to one person you know, everybody listening. It will make a huge difference, mean the world to me. And I missed all of you while I was on vacation. I love being with my family, but I missed all of you because you're all with me. Shields high.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.